Welcome to Season 2 of the Knack for Business podcast. Today's topic is Business Valuation for Dummies. Your host is Bernie Fransgroth from Creative Insight, and his co-host is Wayne Pratt from Motivate You Inc. Gentry Learning, our sponsor, has crafted an exclusive collection of courses designed for individuals needing more how-to information in real estate investments. Additional details can be obtained by tuning into the popular Property Wizard podcast. Check out gentrylearning.com for more details. Our guest today is Caroline Troy from Troy Valuations. Caroline Troy founded Troy Valuations in January 2012. Since that time, she's led the firm to prominence in business valuation and advisory, handling high-profile assignments across public and private sectors. Her expertise, honed through over two decades in Canadian capital markets, extends to guiding entities on expansion, financing, and restructuring strategies. Caroline holds a bachelor's degree in economics from the University of Calgary, an MBA from Wilfrid Laurier University, and the Chartered Business Valuator designation from the CBV Institute. Recognized as an expert witness in Alberta's Court of King's Bench, Caroline's insights bridge traditional finance with emerging technological and sustainability trends. Her forward-thinking approach positions her as a key contributor to transformative strategies, reflecting a commitment to excellence and innovation in an evolving global market.
Caroline, welcome. And what is your favorite quote or saying?
Ties in with my logo. So I want to tell you a story.
Sure.
Once, when I was an IB working for SPI, I went to NYC to talk to an EPM about IPO for SDX. And while I was there, the EPM told me that if I gave him another TLA, I would be out on my A double dollar sign. So this actually happened. Now, you might not know what I just said there, so I'll go through it again.
Yes. I was going there going, that's a lot of acronyms. I worked in healthcare, and well, you just copped it right there.
I know. It ties in, as I said, it ties in with my tagline, which is clear, fair, value. Okay, what happened was I was an investment banker. I was working for a company called Solman Partners. And I went to New York City to talk to an equity portfolio manager. And I was talking with him about getting an order for an initial public offering for a company called Sea Dragon Energy, whose ticker symbol became SDX on the Toronto Stock Exchange. And while I was there, the equity portfolio manager said that if I gave him another TLA, I would be out. And I went, what's a TLA? And he said, exactly. Three-letter acronym. And it was one of the best lessons I ever learned. And it was dealt to me early on. And it meant that I couldn't throw around a bunch of words that people don't understand. Because if I do that, it makes me sound smart, but they don't get what I want them to understand. And therefore, I lose out on the deal, right? So I wanted to be really careful about how I say, what I say, when I say, and in the words that I use so that my meaning is very clear. So yeah, it's and that gets me to clear fair value.
When I saw the notes come in through the over email, and I'm looking at that and going, I wonder how I'm going to explain this one. Because it's like, there's a rhythm to it. It's almost like a little beat, but it's almost a different language.
That's true for finance people. We speak a language that we understand, but a lot of finance people do not.
So what brought you into this business path of being an evaluator?
So it was when I was in investment banking. This was back. So I did my degree in economics. I did my MBA. I went into investment banking. And somewhere in there, at the beginning of that, I realized that I was writing valuation reports for the M&A transactions that we were doing. And I thought, I probably should have some kind of credential that says that I might know what I'm talking about. And there was a choice there between pursuing a CFA, a Chartered Financial Analyst designation, or a CBV. And I decided on CBV because it has a wider application, at least in the Canadian markets. And it focused on things like Canadian tax and Canadian business structure and Canadian business law. And so that helped me in my career. And so that's how I ended up becoming a valuator. Yeah.
What are the principles, the fundamentals of being a valuator?
This is one of my favorite questions. How do I find value in a business? So I want you to think of a triangle, right? Because I don't know how to value a business. except I don't know what this word is, except that if I can carry value inside the triangle composed of 3 points, if I can triangulate that value, then I know that I've got it right or got it close. So the 3 points of the triangle are composed of the present value of future cash flow. So I'm going to use words, but I'm going to come back, specific terms, but I'm going to come back and define them. So present value of future cash flow. And then I'm going to look at it from a market perspective, and I'm going to say, are there some businesses like this business that have transacted in the recent past? And can we use any of the multiples out of those present transactions and apply them to our subject business? And then on the third point of the triangle, I'm going to look at the value of the assets, tangible and intangible. Because the business, most people think of a business, it's got tangible assets. That's what's on the balance sheet. But that's not all that a business is. And you need to look at those intangible assets when you go to value it. But the big one that we want to talk about is the present value of future cash flow. And what does that mean? So if you don't mind, Bernie, I'm going to ask you a question or two. And
go
see
for
if
it.
We can come back here. So Bernie, I owe you $100. Can I pay you in a year from now? Sure.
Sure.
Okay. Perfect. I'll do that deal 100 days long. Because, Bernie, in a year from now, if you want to buy today $100 worth of stuff, you're going to get $100 worth of stuff. But in a year from now, we're running about 5% inflation through 2020. $100 today will only buy $95 worth of stuff in the future. So that's a problem. Secondly, if I have your money, then I can invest your money and earn a rate of return that you forego. So let's say I put it in a GI or Canadian T-bill or something, then I'm going to get a 2 or 3% return. So your $100 is now $95 less what you could have earned on it, which is another 2 or 3%. So now we're down to, say, call it $92. And then you don't know whether or not I'm going to abscond with your money and you'll ever hear from me, right? So there's some default risk and you can quantify that. And then last but not least, there's an economic concept and it's called utility. So if I have your $100, then I can enjoy it. Now I can put it in a GIC or a T-bill or something, or I could buy a sailboat and I can wave at you as I go by on my sailboat that you bought with, I bought with your money, and you sit on the sideline on the beach and watch the sails go by. It's an opportunity cost is really what it comes down to, and it transfers into utility. There's a cost for money. I'm going to bring you back to a lottery ticket. Now, many years ago, if you remember, there was a lottery ticket called Millionaire for Life. And if you scratched and won, the lottery corporation would pay the holder $1,000 a week, $4,000 a month, $52,000 a year for 20 years. And if you added up all of those $1,000 payments, you would get $1 million, something a little bit more than that. And that's why it was called Millionaire for Life. And it was great. But I would argue that last $1,000 payment doesn't have as much value as the first $1,000 payment. How do we get to from future value to present value? So we use this complicated math that gets us from discounting the future value of money to the present value. That's that future cash flow. That's that annuity stream from the lottery ticket. But we put it into present value calculation and determine what that value is worth today. So when I say that there's a time value to money, that goes back to my first example, Bernie, about how much would you need to be compensated if I was going to pay you your $100 in the future? And at the very least, you need to be compensated for the inflation rate and the investment loss, the return on your investment. But you should also look for things like default risk and all the rest of it. So you need to present value that stream of cash flows back to present value. And that's what that top of the triangle looks like. Market perspective, asset perspective. If I get it in the triangle, I'm pretty happy I got it.
Well, you just explained why my bank wants their money back.
Yes.
With interest. So with terms interest. And conditions. With terms and conditions are really important and collateral, right? You just explained the, you know what? It's really interesting you mentioned that. There was a, I think it was the early 1900s, a famous person, famous family. In other words, they have wealth. And what the guy did was he bought a company and said, listen, I give you a promissory note for the company, same concept, then sold, absorbed it into his company, sold shares. It's probably highly illegal now. Sold the share. It could be. I don't know. It just seemed very schemey, right? It had that.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you very much. He acquired this division or this company. And it was in the US, and then he created another company of which that company that he bought now became part of, put it on for shares for stock. So he paid this, pretty good money for the early 1900s. He paid like 10 or 12 million. And he ended up generating $73 million in cash, flipped the company out, sold it. So he ended up getting $73 million, covered the original debt, and then swung it around and sold the company off and then paid off his shareholders. And he ended up with a hefty net profit. Is that how that's supposed to work?
I like to see businesses with operating activities, legitimate ones. But it doesn't much matter. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. If somebody thinks that a company's going to make money and they truly believe it, they're going to invest in it.
Rainbows and unicorns. When you read the Globe and Mail, you talk about it launched at $20. It's now worth 70 cents. Do you have colleagues that are considered, I wouldn't call them slippery, but is there a subset of your business that has people in it that are just ruthless three Monty card sharks?
So I'm not in investment banking anymore. And I think you're talking to those guys.
Well, of course, we wouldn't talk about valuators that way.
No, we wouldn't talk about valuators that way. We wouldn't do that. But so you bring up an interesting question. And if I had life and time to do over again, I would want to do a PhD in finance, and that PhD, it would be based on the asymmetry of information in the Canadian capital markets, right? So we have insider trading laws that says if you know something, if you're an insider to a company or you have specific knowledge about a company, you're not permitted to trade on it. And the US is much better at it. But the Canadian regulators follow that idea. And that's where you're seeing your sharks is having better information than the market. And I think that there is asymmetry of information in the market. A lot of the business valuation principles rely on something called the capital asset pricing model. And that CAPM model has been around for a very long time. I can't recall the history to it. But one of the founding assumptions to it is that all information is known by all participants in the market at the same time. So it relies on symmetry of information. That's not how life works. The world is not like that, right? Some people know some things more than other people, and they know them at a different time. And that's what leads to arbitrage. If you have a sense that maybe there's going to be a change in the market, you buy low and you sell high. That's the very nature of capitalism. You buy low, you sell high. And that's a risky event. And some people are better at assessing that risk, and they're better at determining that value at the purchase price and recognizing when it's reached a nice rate of return and you can sell it. Are they sharks? Yes. Are they dragons like Dragon's Den? Yes. Is that a terrible thing? I don't think so. The difference is whether or not it's done, what's the word I'm looking for? Within the law, without insider trading knowledge, without insider knowledge. So I'll give you another term, which is fair market value. That's usually the standard by which we write our valuation reports. we can rate them to different standards, and the CBB Institute will give you a number of definitions of standards that we can use. But I like to use fair market value. And that comes down to, there's a big long definition, it's technical, and I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to say it's a buyer and a seller. They agree at the highest price at which they're going to transact, and they have good information, but it's perfect and it's not symmetrical. And they don't have to transact. They can walk away. And it's expressed in cash.
So take away the mysteries as much as possible. It almost sounds like when you're buying or selling a house, right? Someone comes up and it says, what's that puppy worth in the window? This is what it is worth. But which brings me to the next question, is the market conditions. If there is a bidding war, then that house has just increased in value. So what are the conditions that affect valuation in a business? Obviously, bidding wars are a nice thing. So simple supply and demand. Demand is high, supply is low, right? Are there any other aspects that affect that?
Yeah, there's general economic conditions, right? So how much is it going to cost you to borrow money? Mm-hmm. What's the riskiness of the business itself? What is the riskiness of the industry? What's the timing? I've got a great article on my website about timing of a acquisition and consequently valuation report, right? Our opinion. I would argue that if you were interested in, say, a company that offers cruise ship services, that you could rent berths on a cruise ship, mm-hmm. that value would be hugely different March 31, 2020, than it was at December 31, 2019. As every cruise ship got berthed, they were done. They were dry docked, were essentially what it was. They couldn't move. And then how long was it going to stay that way? At March 31, nobody knew.
Right.
So timing is a huge thing. Which way is the economy going? Which way is the industry going? How much does money cost? What's the cost of money? These are all big inputs into the valuation.
Similar to my earlier one, we all hear about what I would call greed and stupidity. And everyone who's trying to start a startup, he always talks about the hockey stick. There's 6 billion people in the world, and I'll get 1% of them all. So give me $100 million. And no. Tell me about the creative finance of the startup that has more to do with myth and romance than reality.
100%. Great question. I think of successful companies having three leg, like a stool, right? And the first leg is they have to have an ass, whatever that is, right? And for, say, for you guys, it's this podcast. It's an ass. No, before. The second thing is you have to have effective management, right? Management has to be good. They have to be operationally good. And if they've had success in the past, then they have a lower risk of not having success in the future, right? So that's the second thing. The third thing is capital. And money always follows good assets and good management. So where's the risk in that? The risk is, in general, it's in execution. How do you get a lot of money? You've got this brand new technology, and you're going to start slow, but there's 100 million people on this planet that are going to really like your product. And if you take a small percentage, 2% of that 100 million, and it's a $20 product, the sky's the limit. That's a problem. You make a forecast. You forecast out exactly on that principle, right? How big's your target market? What percentage of your target market's going to buy it? What's the cost of it? And that's going to be your revenue in the future. But we go back to that winning lottery ticket and annuity, and you say, what's the present value of that revenue stream? And then where is the cost? If it's a technology company, all those costs are up front, and you have to sink all those costs before your product's ready to go. But let's say you're a retail store, right? And that you've got to buy inventory every month or every year to sell in your retail store. So those costs are incurred just as revenues earned. But that technology company, you have to incur all those costs up front and pay all those back before you can show profitability. So it really comes down to how you are defining profitability and where your costs are, and ultimately how much you discount the revenue. So when it's me and I'm looking at a technology company like that, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at the prior success of the management team and do a risk analysis on execution and determine the value from that, discount that present value cash flow.
It sounds like there's a whole bunch of different methodologies that you deploy to do the valuation. I know you talked about the triangle, right? What's the market say about the idea? So if you're building carriages for horses and it's now the year 2000 and not the year 1900, it is a different emphasis. So there's a different push. And now you just mentioned some other aspects. What things do you bring? What aspects do you look at? Obviously, where's the bank at? Who's the team? I get that part. What other elements do you take into consideration when you're providing a valuation?
So we put the business in its economic and industry context, right? That's the first thing we do. We look at the company's cost structure and its margins. And so we use what I call a common size income statement. So everything, all the categories are a ratio of or a percentage of total revenue. And what that does is it identifies where the costs are incurred in that business. We look at the profitability of that business. We look at the return on equity, the return on capital. We look at how it's structured. How is the business financed? We look at its asset base relative to its operations. We take a brief look at the capability of its assets to deliver the product or services that it's looking for and it's looking to provide. It's comprehensive. It's not just a single thing. And then we apply, when then we're back to that triangle, right? If we analyze all of those risks, that helps us understand where it is, right? If it's a good company or if it's not a good company, right? And if it's not as profitable as its competitors, then it probably gets a lower valuation. If it's top of the market, then you got to give it the higher valuation. But that's where so this is going to lead into your next question, but that's where the risk assessment comes from. And that's where the expert can provide insight into the value.
It's interesting that I get the concepts, but if you're in a startup mode, how do you peg yourself? Because you don't have enough, let's say you're year one or maybe year two, you may not have enough back data to work with. How do you factor in, let's say, a startup? Is there another added element that you tap into, especially if it's like a new idea? If you think back to the first iPhone or the first BlackBerry, right? Before that was Nokia. Pretty solid, pretty simple, straightforward. Not your smartphone, but as smart as they're going to get. And then someone comes up with a BlackBerry. Now, how do you provide a valuation on something like that that close to being proven is like the idea feels hot. You ask your neighbor, feels like it's a great idea. But now, how do you provide guidance in that, especially if you're going somewhere else with that valuation for a reason? How do you provide more insight?
So history has got, stock markets and history have got great indicators for that. So if you remember in 1999, we had the e-commerce boom where he likes that. Yeah, Dwayne. Yeah, you're right. We had valuations of 20 times revenue, forecast revenue in 3 years or something, right? For, I don't know, petfood.com or something, right? And really that comes down to a risk assessment, right? How risky is this business? One of the things that I look for is it's the difference between maybe what Berkshire Hathaway invests in versus what cryptocurrency guys invest in. Right? Crypto guys, they're going to go intangible assets, high risk, high return, and we'll just eat the risk, right? Whereas Berkshire Hathaway, they invest in railroads. They're looking at the tangible asset base, right? The things that you can see and touch. And so this is another component that I probably should talk about with respect to valuation is understanding the components of value in a business. When you think about, when most people, when they think about a business, I don't know, give me a business podcast. Okay. So here's your business. Yes. So your business is largely intangible assets, right? It is business technology, but it's also your audience on your various streaming platforms. It's your networking group. It's your ability, your individual ability to do interviews effectively. It's your ability to communicate effectively, to find sponsors for your podcast, to gain the audience that you will have. But there is some there are some tangible assets, right? There are the communication devices that we're using. You own those. That's the studio you've got. Those are your tangible assets. So when you look at your balance sheet that your accountant produces, the intangible assets never show up there. But for me, they exist because I can see them. And they exist because you can see them. CRA can't see them. They don't know that those exist because the accountants don't tell them that. But when you go to sell the business, then you're gonna say, I'm going to sell the tangible stuff, the communications equipment, and maybe the studio lease, right? But then I'm going to sell all the other intangible stuff. So when I think about the value components in the business, I'm going to talk about the tangible assets, the things in touch. And then I'm going to talk about the identifiable intangible assets. And those would be patents, processes, secret recipes, technologies, independent technologies. It might be a dedicated workforce, educated, dedicated workforce. These are things that you can attribute value to. And then there's goodwill. And that is the unidentifiable, intangible asset. And it means everything else. So if you say that, let's say the business is worth $100. Right? That's the present value of future cash flow, and that's value from a market perspective. Then we allocate, say, in the podcast world of business, we would allocate maybe $20 to the tangible assets, really, because our technology, right, our cell phones and these things, they become obsolete in 2 years. So a very low number for the tangible assets. Then I would allocate, if you had a patent on this, or you had a dedicated process to this, a trademark of some kind, then I would allocate a value to that, and then everything else goes into the goodwill bucket. Then there's, on top of the value stack of buckets, there is one more, and you guys will like this. This is the net economic value added. And it comes from the willingness of a purchaser to pay more for a business than it's actually worth. Whoa, he says, okay, if you identify that strategic interest purchaser, we can attribute value and figure out how much more they're going to pay for your business than it's actually worth. So if your business is worth, say, $100, we've allocated 20 to the tangible assets and 30 to the intangible. So that gives us 50 and $50 for the goodwill. And then we might be able to extract another $10 or $20 from somebody who particularly wants this business. Now, why would they do that? They want to extend their geographic reach. They want to extend their customer reach. They want to improve their utilization rates. They want to increase their capacity. They're going to get G&A synergies. That's probably the biggest one and easiest to find, right? You don't need two CEOs. You don't need two CFOs. You don't need two accountants. You don't need two HR people. You can let those ones go, and that G&A savings then improves the larger company's profitability, right? Take two guys, small guys, and put them together. So there's this thing on the top, net economic value added. You can quantify that value. And so when you go to sell the business, you'll actually get more than it's worth. But in general, that's what we want to talk about. It's the tangible assets, the intangible assets, identifiable, and then intangible assets, not identifiable, is goodwill. So
you've alluded to something that begs an obvious example. When you run into someone like Elon Musk, who makes decisions that look a lot like they're fueled by medication than common sense, how does an evaluator not rip at all their hair?
That's back down to the risk assessment and on execution. And that guy's got a really low execution risk. Okay, he invented a car company that he put into the rocket company, right, to the rocket by the rocket company and sent them both to space, right? Like, crazy. And then on top of that, he's got the Boring Company and who knows what else, right? Starlink and everything else. He's a golden boy, right? There's very few people who can touch that. But what that is execution risk. And he's figured it out. I've found, in my experience, that there are some entrepreneurs that they unlock the problem. They figured it out. And once they've done it once, they can do it again. And they can do it in the same industry or in an adjacent industry. And if they're really good, they can go into an industry that's unrelated and do it again. And that's the execution risk that I was talking about.
I've been told that private equity has all but eliminated the IPO. I was wondering what your opinion on that was.
So you're talking about knowledge that I maybe don't have, right?
No, I think I may be on a hobby horse. I've been told that companies that are investment companies, like the people you mentioned, are buying pieces of companies, holding them longer, and the IPO is either non-existent, way out, or not part of the real puzzle anymore.
Public listing of companies is a risky activity. So if you're in an early stage and you're looking for capital, it depends on what the private equity company is interested in, right? And whatever the hot flavor of the month is, right? A week, a day, whatever. They will be interested in investing in those products or whatever it is. And they're going to be segmented into companies that are cash flow stable and investments in companies that are 10 to 1, right? So the investment company is going to have a portfolio view of their investments, right? They're going to say, especially if it's high risk, it's one of these startups, technology startups that doesn't have any history, but it's got great management, right? And it's got a pretty good looking asset. Then they're going to say, okay, we'll take $10 million and we'll put $1 million in 10 different investments. And one will be a 10 bagger. And three or four will be dead on arrival. And the remainder will limp along until we can get rid of them. And if they're really lucky, then maybe two out of 10 or 10 baggers, and they'll make all that money. So that's one kind of investment company. And you'll often see, for tech companies, you'll often see that they're going to go to a PE firm like that, a high risk, high reward private equity firm like that, prior to going public, because they have a small number of shareholders. They then can use their direct communication with their shareholders to keep them informed and involved in the business. And the shareholders themselves, private equity guys, can then look after their investments. Whereas if you go to a public market listing, there's a lot of distance between management and shareholders because there's so many of them. And there's a whole reporting cost associated with a public listing that you won't find in a private equity funded firm. And so there are different investors for different products. That's part of what makes the arbitrage work.
So valuation. There's a purpose behind it, and the purposes can be driven from different directions.
Yeah.
What was it? The famous artists, for example, that have music, they sell it to one of the major record labels, yeah, or recording companies for millions and millions of dollars. And you're sitting there going, you may have loved the artist. You'd listen to the tune again, but they've just you know, dumped a boatload of cash in there. And the artist is happy, et cetera. And they now that company owns the rights.
Yep.
That's someone's obviously worked out a valuation. What are the other reasons that people work out valuations? And how long does it take to come around to do a valuation? You know, obviously size matters, right? And complexity. But, yeah, what drives evaluation and how long does it typically take based either on the complexity? Is it dollar value or estimated dollar value or is it size of company or what?
So that's a complicated question. Let me answer it in two parts. So why would you need evaluation? So I look at it and say anytime a company is going to undertake a transaction that's going to involve either all of their assets or all of their equity, some or portion of their equity. So those can be for the purposes of, unfortunately, negotiating a divorce settlement. Okay, so let me just start here. Don't get a divorce if you can help, please.
Thanks.
But if you do, and there's a business involved, then you want to call Troy Valuations because we provide expert opinions. We're experts at court, expert opinions on the value of the business for the purpose of divorce, to negotiate an equitable settlement of your divorce. And I see that as a win. I don't want to go to court. And the business owner probably does want to go to court and have a judge decide. So let's get a valuation in which you will be successful in your negotiation. When anytime you are undertaking a transaction that involves your assets or your equity, I look at it akin to Google Maps. I know where I am and I know where I want to go. But unless you know the value of the business, and you may not know where you are today, you may know where you want to go. I'm prepared to give my ex-wife $100 million, but you're only worth $10 today. And you need to understand where you are now so you can determine where you want to go. So that's, and that gives you that strength and that negotiating power. So the first reason why you need one is, or one of the big reasons is negotiating a divorce settlement. This is also true if you are negotiating a litigation claim. Either you are the plaintiff or you are the defendant and some harm has occurred of some kind, a breach of contract, I don't know, personal injury, who knows? There's a whole bunch of reasons why. Wrongful dismissal, who knows? Then you can quantify the business and the effect, the value of the business before the event occurred and the value after the event occurred and determine the cost of the event, the damages associated with the event. So when we do that, we're looking at like a breach of contract and how much did that cost the company or how much did that cost the countersigning party for the breach of the contract. We don't say whether or not the breach actually occurred, because that goes to the trier of the fact, and that's the trial judge. But if the trial judge should find that the event occurred and the consequences derived from that event are in play, then the value would be XYZ. So that's another reason for litigation. We do it for tax planning purposes. So let's say your business has, you've got OpCo, operation company. And then you've got Real Estate Co. And RobCo pays Real Estate Co. rent, and Real Estate Co. owns the real estate, pays the bank. And then beside that, you got Rental Co. And Rental Co. rents equipment to OpCo. And OpCo pays back Rental Co., who then pays the bank whatever they owe for the rent, for the mortgage on the assets. But it's complicated, right? So what you want to do is you want to put HoldCo on top. And you might even want to put Trust Co. on top of that, and you have now Family Trust, Hold Co., and now you have separation of business operations. But those are what we call related party transactions. And that's when CRA gets involved. Because CRA says, you sold your company to your brother, right? Did he pay fair market value for that? And so then you hire Troy Valuations before you do the transaction. And when CRA comes knocking and says, was that fair market value? And can we have our capital gains money, please? Then you hold up the Troy Valuations valuation report as the shield against CRA that comes knocking and says, was it fair market value?
Well, I got a quick question. It's only because I don't understand. Obviously, if CRA can ask for that,
yep,
that means they can demand it. My question is, if I sell something for $1 or $2 and it's worth $100, if I have a Mercedes and I sell it for $10, I understand the capital asset, right? And yes, I can understand the game being played to shaft the system so it doesn't realize the proper tax value. But at the same time, does that not intrinsically go against the construct of, if I own the asset and I'm not defrauding anybody, like I'm not defrauding a bank, not defrauding the shareholders, but I sell off the asset, I'm the sole owner, 100%, and I sell it off for a dollar. I know I can, for example, if I own a car in this province, I can sell it off to a close family member for a dollar. And the state accepts that as a family transaction, related parties. They let you do that, right? So you don't have to pay the full tax. So I'm just trying to understand. I understand why CRA would want to know the proper value. And if this is going off course too much, let me know. But couldn't you make the case, I sold it because it's a gift or it has something else? Or is there more to it than that?
For business purposes, I don't know about personal.
Okay.
And I'm not a tax expert in either realm. But for business purposes, capital gains and capital losses have tax effects. Okay. And you can use capital losses 3 years back and 7 years ahead to offset capital gains. If you are doing a corporate transaction and you have transacted at a value that's not fair market value to a related party, I understand that CRA is interested in that to ensure that there is no tax avoidance on the transaction. Because if you sell it to your brother at a dollar, then that becomes the adjusted cost base for that capital asset. And when he sells it, he's going to bear the capital gain on it, not the first seller. So there's a longer stream of consequences other than just that immediate single transaction. And CRA is interested in capital asset transactions because they persist through time with related parties. That's my understanding of it. And I consult your tax lawyer because they know, and your tax accountant, because they know way, way more than I do, but I determine fair market value.
I understand the purpose, I understand the intent, but now that you've explained that it holds, it's not a one-time a moment. The car depreciates in value. The capital asset, not so much. So like if you're talking about a structure, for example, then you want into as long as the building stands. Cool.
I got a question for you. And it may be outside, but I think you probably have an opinion. The value of the valuation. Mar-a-Lago, I say it's worth $1 billion one day and it's worth $17 million the next day. And I'm playing both sides against the middle to be cute. What does a valuation do to cement that or put it in concrete so that you can't just decide that today's the day where I'm asking $1 billion and I say it's $1 billion, so it's $1 billion?
I don't know quite how to answer this one. And I'd much rather answer the first question that you gave me, Bernie, about how long it takes to write one. We'll get back to that valuation report question because I don't think I answered. Okay. A valuation, let's go back and say this for clarity. A valuation report is an opinion. It's an opinion of the value. It's not an actual transaction in which you've actually created a price, right? If we're going to do business valuation, we're never going to expose the business to the market and say, how much would you pay for this? Like you would in an auction, for example, right? And it's really no different than, say, the city of Calgary or the city that you live in assesses the value of your property so that they can tax you on it. right? It's an opinion. Now, you can disagree with that opinion and provide evidence of for support of your disagreement of the opinion, but it's only just an opinion until there's an actual transaction. So what is Mar del Lago? I don't know, but it's somewhere between X and Y. And there's reasons why there are buyers and sellers, right? There's reasons why some people want that really high price and there's some people who would really like that low value. And if it was adjudicated by a court, then the court decides. And if it's a market transaction, then the market will decide. But until that time, it's just an opinion. And it's got to be supported in fact, and it has to be testable.
Right.
And that's how we find value.
I think you're actually on to where I was going.
Okay.
Let's assume that you want a valuation to borrow money. The Bank of Montreal says, I have to have a valuation to borrow this $200,000 line of credit.
Okay. Right.
And you come back and you come up with a number. Now, things change. The economy can change.
COVID happens. You know,
all kinds of things happen. But the actual opinion, if you will, what tarnishes it? What calls it into question, if anything? How definitive can the bank bet on the valuation from you as the letter of the law?
Good question. Valuations are based on assumptions. Every report that I write has a section in which we enumerate our assumptions. And in fact, I got a little hyperlink inside my document that takes you from one place to another to see the assumption, and then you can test that assumption. First of all, it relies on data, but then it relies on assumptions. And you need to test those assumptions and which ones are more likely and which ones are less likely. And some of those assumptions are the big ones, like you're suggesting, Wayne, like execution risk for management or industry risk for the type of industry, if it's a brand new product in a technology space, then that risk needs to be assessed. And that's a subject. It's a subject item, not a factual item. And that means that there's an assumption associated with it. And then that valuation report has got to be able to support your assumption. So when you're testing whether or not, if you're BMO and you're saying, okay, is this company is it any good? Let's read the report. Let's identify the assumptions and let's see what support is in there for the assumptions that are made. And that's how you test.
What's the shelf life of valuation?
About a minute and a half.
That's a really volatile space.
It can be. And it, right, it's so the valuation is always tied to an effective date, right? Because we need to know what the value of the tangible assets is as at that date. So how much money does the company have in its bank account? That's a definitive number. And if tomorrow they get paid, then that number is going to change or they pay the bills, right? So that's right. That's a very drastic change. But I'll go back to my example of the cruise ship company in December 2019 and March 2020. That was a 3-month gap. And you saw during that time, the price of oil, I don't know. So I'm in Alberta, so price of oil is important here. If you recall, the price of oil actually went negative during that time. And that was a market failure. It was depends on whether you were a buyer or a seller at that point. So when you're thinking about a valuation report, is generally fit for purpose, right? You're using it to negotiate your divorce, and then it stands for that term of that negotiation period. But when you're then done with that and you want to go out and sell your business and that negotiation for the divorce has already gone into the past, you may need another one. And you shouldn't use the valuation for your divorce for buying and selling your business because there may be different assumptions in there. There may be information that shouldn't be shared with the purchaser of your business when you're talking about the assets used in the term of the marriage, whatever it is. So it's a bit facetious for me to say it's a minute and a half because it can have a really long lifespan, but it can change rapidly.
you know, the factors driving it will, if they float fast, then everything floats fast with it.
Correct. And
it totally makes sense.
This is not an industry that our listeners consider themselves experts on, even though some of them should know the rough details. What are some takeaways you'd like to leave us so that the listener is educated in your mind?
I think the one thing that if you're going to look at a business, you're going to buy it, you're going to sell it, you're going to negotiate on it, probably the principal determination of that business is its cash flow. And how do you get to cash flow? So there's lots of different ways. And that's one of those words that, you know, it has a technical term in accounting. It has, for small business, they don't usually use that technical term. They use net profit, or they use net revenue, which are also misnomers. For me, when I talk about cash flow, or the one that I'm really interested in, is earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization. EBITDA. That's the number I'm interested in. And what does that do? And how long is it stable over time? If you've got EBITDA that fluctuates within 10% over 5 years, that's an absolutely stunningly beautiful company. And if it's of a certain size, then that PE buyer is going to want to buy it because they're looking for that stable cash flow because there are no surprises there. It's just an annuity. And that's what stable investors want to have. If that's the kind of investment they want to make, because that is, it's a thing of joy to see that for me. But that's the principal value, I think, of a business is what's the cash flow in that business? What's the EBITDA and how stable is it?
How do folks reach you?
They can get me at troyvalue.com. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Facebook. And that principally come through my website at troyvalue.com. That's T-R-O-Y, V as in Victor, A-L-U-E.com. You can email me at ctroy@troyvalue.com. You can find me on LinkedIn and you can find us on Facebook.
Thank you to Carolyn Troy, my co-host Wayne Pratt, and you, the Knack for Business listeners. Another great podcast, another great guest. To reach me, info@creativeinsight.com, info@creativeinsight.com. The website is creativeinsight.com. Wayne, how can folks reach you, sir?
Best way is my website, motiveyou.ca, M-O-T-I-V-E, the numeral 8, the letter U, .ca. And my email is wayne@motiveyou.ca.
Thank you for listening to Wayne Pratt and Bernie Franzgroth. For these podcasts, we'd like to acknowledge the support and thanks to the following people. Carl Richards from Podcast Solutions Made Simple, a renowned podcast expert. Fred Crouch, who is the Property Wizard podcast, where Bernie is a co-host. Then Melanie Weber, Bernie's invaluable business partner. And Wayne Pratt from Motivate You, Inc., who serves as both a coach and co-host of these podcasts. Disclaimer, please note that the Knack for Business podcast episodes are meant solely for educational and general informational purposes. The information and opinions contained within are not intended to be professional advice on any subject matter. The thoughts, views, and opinions expressed by the participants are their own personal beliefs and do not represent the views of the podcast hosts or any affiliated organizations. It is important to note that this podcast is not a replacement for consulting with certified experts in your area who possess knowledge of your unique situation. The hosts of the podcast, along with any participants or affiliated groups, do not take responsibility for any actions taken or not taken based on the information presented in this episode. It is highly recommended that individuals seek guidance from their own personal advisors in fields such as accounting, law, or other pertinent areas prior to undertaking any actions or making decisions that may impact their financial, legal, or other aspects of life.